This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2011 annual conference. The session is by Dana Boyd, social scientist for Microsoft Corporation, and is entitled Privacy in an Era of Social Media.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming out today. I have to say, it's great to be here. It's so exciting to see so much energy and enthusiasm about issues of technology and higher education. It warms my heart in such a good way. This morning I wanted to talk with you about some of my research and some of the things that I've been seeing popping up. And I want to begin with a refrain that has been driving me absolutely crazy. It's a refrain that we hear over and over again in the media and that we hear permeate a lot of conversations about kids and technology. So the refrain, that the idea that kids don't care about privacy. Now, I've been spending a lot of time with young people over the years, mostly teenagers, but also college-age students, and one of the things that becomes extremely clear to me is that they do care about privacy. Yet, one of the things that happens is that because they're participating in social media, the popularity of social network sites, this is seen as proof that privacy is dead. And it's not, you know, there's a good reason for this. We see amazing amount of content being produced on Facebook, MySpace, Tumblr, Twitter, DeviantArt, 4chan, you name it, we're seeing people participate. And yet, at the same time, they're trying to figure out how to actually understand privacy in their lives. So my talk today is really about drilling down and providing a way of understanding what's going on about privacy. And you may wonder, why should you care about this? And what I'm arguing is that privacy is actually a model for understanding what's at stake and what's changing because of networked media. And it's imperative that we actually understand how young people are grappling with this in order to think about how we innovate in this space. Now, it's important to realize that young people don't actually know how to define privacy any better than most adults. It's a very confusing concept. But one of the things that becomes very clear when I hear young people try to describe what privacy means to them is that they have a very positive valence towards it. It's something that they think positively about. It's about things that are personal, it's about things that are intimate, etc. So instead of hearing young people talk or eschew privacy, I often hear them try to find a way to actually achieve privacy while revealing its complexities. I want you to consider this quote by Bly Loretano Werner. It comes from a youth radio report that she put together in 2006, where she lamented her mother's refusal to give her space online. And what Bly said is that, you know, my mom always uses the excuse about the internet being public when she defends herself. It's not like I do anything to be ashamed of, but a girl needs her privacy. I do online journals so I can communicate with my friends, not so my mother can catch up on the latest gossip of my life. Now, what Bly is really pointing out in this quote is this interesting issue about how she's trying to achieve privacy with her peers, which are separate from what's going on with adults. All of our contemporary conversations about privacy tend to focus on the idea that privacy is about the control of data or the strict control of information. Yet when young people like Bly talk about the idea of privacy, what they highlight is that privacy actually has two critical components. First is the ability to have agency within a social situation. And second is to be able to control that social situation. For young people, privacy is about having the freedom to control a situation in light of environments of surveillance, in light of the attempts that are to undermine privacy by educators, by parents, by law enforcement, by all of these actors that they're trying to negotiate. And it's a particularly odd thing to do in a very public environment. So this talk, as I sort of dive deep into what's going on in privacy and I untangle what we see with Bly, is really meant to provide you with a way of thinking. And the reason for this is that I actually strongly believe that we need to have critical conversations about what's happening in a networked era. And I think you as educators, and especially as educators who are invested in technology, play an absolutely critical role in this. What this means is that you need to grapple with all of the weird changes that are happening, the things that are so awesome and empowering about technology, but also the things that seem really strange. And the more that you understand the complexities, the more that you have a critical understanding of what's at stake, the more that you can help young people navigate this. And also, as we think about employing all of these new technologies into the space, it's about understanding what those shifts are about. So with that basic definition, a basic sense of what's going on today, I want to talk about young people's participation in social media. right? I think there's a lot of people in this room are really excited about the educational potentials of social media, but why is it that young people go and participate in it? For most American youth, what you will hear over and over again is that participation becomes an absolute social necessity. It's the place that they have to go if they want to hang out with their friends. It's the equivalent of the mall when I was growing up. It's the equivalent of the student center on many of your campuses. It's a place where you go to see and be seen. It's a place where you have a sense of all of what's happening in your social environment. And failure to participate in these social environments online ends up being excluded from a lot of social culture, which becomes a really tricky thing for young people. Now, Facebook is by and large the dominant player in this space, both at the high school level and actually at the college level, which is sort of interesting to watch how that's played out. And the expectation is a really interesting expectation, one that we should sort of think critically about for a moment. So as Abigail points out, you're expected to be on Facebook, you know, and I sort of asked, well, what would happen if you weren't? And she said, well, people would ask you why. You'd have to have a good reason. If you didn't have a good reason, people would like, you know, the internet at my house isn't working. But if you didn't have a good reason, like I'm not on it, people would be like, why? Get on it. Make an account. You don't have to pay for it. So I feel like people have that expectation. It's expected you're on Facebook. So what you hear from her is she's talking about this sort of expectation with the idea that it's free. And that's a really interesting trigger in all of this because, especially as we're talking about privacy, there's always a cost to it. We have to think through that. Now, the popular social media for young people very much varies depending on the communities that they're in. And it keeps shifting over the years. And since I started studying what young people were doing online, I started actually with LiveJournal, with Blogger, went into MySpace, have studied Facebook. We keep seeing these shifts and these transitions. And you're going to keep seeing them. And at this point, the dominant players are very much about Facebook and about text messaging or cell phone activities. But there's an amazing emergence of niche sites, small communities that are going to specific places because they want to carve out a smaller community. Certainly you're seeing this with Tumblr. You're also actually seeing this with how young people use Twitter. But you're certainly seeing this with DeviantArt and all of these other spaces. It's also really important to think in a higher ed environment what it means to engender the kinds of niche spaces that go on. But what drives participation on any one of these sites is the ability to be there because everybody else is there. And what makes it interesting is goes beyond the idea that it's just popular, but it is the fact that everybody is on it, and you can actually see people over time, so there's a broader sense of network, and there's an idea that there's a constant flow of information. Right? And you're seeing all of this come together in really powerful ways in terms of participation. And when we think about a learning environment, it's important to realize that learning often happens when people feel as though they've come together. Not when they're forced to, but when they feel as though they can build the networks and the communities where they can reach out to a broader audience. Now, of course, the funny thing about these media is it also means that there's a lot of material kept around and the persistence of it becomes powerful. For those who are remote, one of the things Lana says is that it's a scrapbook of your social life. Now, the fact that it's highly popular in social makes it very difficult as we think of an educational environment, because we always have to balance these issues. How do we deal with what it means to construct an education space and make certain that young people who are going to it for social reasons have that support? Now, the way that I like to think about the construction of these things is as the notion of a networked public. Now, a public space is something that we can have a mental model of, right? We think about the town square, or we think about what happens when people gather. The way to understand what a network public is that it's like a public, except that these are simultaneously spaces that are constructed through network technologies, as well as the imagined community that is a result of people coming together. And it's the combination of these two that creates the sense of togetherness. But it's also what complicates it. Because one of the challenges of network publics is that they're not necessarily exactly like other forms of publics. And there's properties that are really different about them. So when young people go to a networked public, it's important to realize that they're actually making a specific move. They want to be in a public. That's very different than the idea that they want to be public. And here's where we get back to the privacy issue. Just because people want to go and participate in a public doesn't mean that they want everything that they've ever said to be publicized to all people across all space and all time. There's a really significant difference there. And we are seeing vast numbers of young people go in and try to participate in publics, but that doesn't mean that they want everything that they have to be out there for the world to see. So this leads us to the issue of architecture. Social media changes the very architecture of how people interact. This is the beauty, power, and cost of networks, right? We can connect to people across all space and all time, but that doesn't mean we actually are doing so. We're constantly struggling with it. In the past, I've talked about four different properties that become really important to think about: persistence, searchability, replicability, and the issues of scalability. All of these sort of affect our architecture. But with respect to publics and privacy, part of it is that teams understand, in particular, that there's a shift happening. They understand that something's not quite the way it used to be, and they're trying to make sense of it, and they're trying to speak back to adults about it. Even without a historical perspective, they realize that there's a fundamental change. And I use a quote here from Alicia because I think it highlights this. I think the technology is redefining what's acceptable for people to put up about themselves. I've grown up with technology, so I don't know how it was before in this boom of social networking. But it just seems like instead of spending all of our time talking to individual people and sharing things that would seem private, we spend our time putting it up in one module of communication where people can just go and access it if they want to. Think about that. That is a radical shift. It's the idea of pushing things out versus creating a place where other people can pull. Right? And we've talked about this in the education community for a long time, right? The difference between teaching and espousing versus providing modules where people can come to it. But young people are recognizing that there's something about their social environment, the places in which they're living, where this shift is part of it. And at the root of this is a really radical difference in how we negotiate information flows. If we were having a conversation in an unmediated environment, our interactions would be private by default, public with effort. Right, we would be talking and we'd be talking, and you might share something that I said, and that would be fine. Most likely you're not going to share everything that I said, just because it's going to take a lot of effort, and most of what I say isn't that interesting. So you're going to pick and you're going to choose and you're going to share the appropriate things. But yet what happens online is a shift of this. In a mediated environment, even in this kind of environment, things become public by default, private through effort. What this means is the act of participating in social media means that you have to share things at a much greater level of visibility. It means that they're shared for a public. It may not be all people across all space and all time, but it's certainly your peer group, it's certainly the people you care about. And you have to then make choices of what to make private. This is particularly true given the affordances of these particular technologies, right, where it's actually a lot easier to make things public than it is to make them private. For example, I talk to a lot of young people who take tons and tons of pictures, right? And they put them all up on Facebook, they let their friends tag them, and they wait until somebody complains before taking it down. Why? It's a lot easier to post all of the photos than to go through manually and figure out which ones to post and which ones to remove. Likewise, we see this as a constant act of like share first, remove later. Right? This is a very weird way of thinking about things, but it becomes part of how the infrastructure works and how young people understand their engagement with it. Now, just because things are public by default doesn't mean that private communication is gone. Even in the most popular social media, there's a tremendous amount of private communication, even directed private communication. What's really interesting to me is to watch how people choose what to make private rather than choosing what to make public. Right? So young people will go through this process of saying, well, that might be embarrassing, or I really want to have this intimate conversation, so I will go and make that private. But if it's kind of mundane or pithy and it doesn't really matter, sure, I'll share it. Why does it matter? Right? And that's such a mental shift, that the result of which is that we have a ton of pithy, mundane content publicly available, because why bother hiding it? Right? And that's sort of that part of that shift. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't exhibitionists. And I'm sure many of you are seeing your students doing all sorts of things that you're like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? There are undoubtedly massive quantities of exhibitionists. I can't say that it's so radically different than in the past. It's just that the tools for exhibitionism make you do it at a scale that's far greater. But the thing time, it's also a weird element where that exhibitionism has a sense of control to it. So Meijing is sort of highlighting this. She talks about how she's an extroverted person. And she says, well, I do care about privacy, but if I found someone that I could trust, then the first instinct would be to share stuff with them, right? And that's a sentiment that we keep seeing, where it's like sharing is a part of negotiating, part of being friends. And it's interesting to see how she takes the idea of sharing to an extreme. I was particularly fascinated by her idea of passwords. She decides she's going to share her passwords with her boyfriend. It just made me feel safer because someone was there to help me out and stuff. It made me feel more connected and less lonely. Because I feel like Facebook sometimes it's kind of like a lonely sport. I feel like you're sitting there and you're looking at people by yourself. But if someone knows your password and stuff, it just feels better. Right? And again, this is a very weird mindset, especially from adult perspective. I warn you, the numbers of password sharing amongst friends and peers are probably about 50%. And it's even higher when you start to involve parents in all of this. Password sharing, rather than being the idea of controlling and I just have my identity online, it's like sharing is a way of making yourself feel connected. In some ways, it's not unlike the locker combinations when I was in high school, which is, of course, we'd share our locker combinations because we hoped people would leave good things for us, right? It was really hopeful. You come to your locker and you've got a surprise. That's awesome. You kind of knew it was coming, but you really were still excited. The same thing ends up happening online, where password sharing is a way of feeling connected. And it's a way of being very public, which again is really nerve-wracking from an adult perspective. Now, of course, on the flip side, there are also young people who are not interested in sharing and find this whole thing very, very intimidating and are unconfident about everything that's going on, don't like the monitoring, don't like what they have to do to participate. And sometimes this has sort of more narrow and niche elements. So consider Taylor. She talks about how she doesn't like that people are in her business. It really bothers her. And she realizes that they're friends and they mean well, but they always put themselves in her business and she doesn't like it. So she finds sites like Facebook really confronting because she doesn't find any way of participating where she's not constantly having to confront people who feel the need to be in her business, even well-intended. Now, the vast majority of teens are actually trying to figure this stuff out. And as they get to college, it sort of takes a whole new level, where they're trying to figure out what the audiences are that they're negotiating, how they look and are seen positively, and at the same time have some sense of fun and freedom to be socializing with their friends. What this means is that they're not crafting their online personas to be read by employers. They're not imagining all of this as like what's going to look good on their CV when they finish the university. They see these sites first and foremost as a social space. But as they get older, they're starting to also grapple with all of these different audiences, and they're trying to find a way to make sense and have privacy in that, with that in mind. Now, what this means is that they're going through a lot of strategies of choosing what to share and what not to. They're messing it up, they put things out there, and then they try to take it back, and they're learning. And from the time that they start participating in social media all the way through the periods in which you see them, they're really going through a learning stage. The dirty secret is, so are you, right? Most adults are still struggling with this. This doesn't magically get solved by the age of 22. Part of it is that learning how to participate in these media and dealing with, unexpected audiences is a really big challenge. Teens and young people are participating in public in order to be a part of the society that we have created, very much a network society. They want to be in that public, and helping them figure out how to grapple with this is part of the challenge. One of the ways of thinking about it, actually, is going back to Baudelaire. He used to talk about the notion of a flâneur who would walk the streets of Paris to see and be seen. Right? And in Baudelaire's model, there were certainly the exhibitionists and there were certainly the voyeurs. But the flâneur was this character who very much was about constantly negotiating audiences. The challenge as we think about what's happening in these network media is that we are creating digital flâneur culture. Right? We're creating an environment where people are going to see and be seen, and we need to help people navigate that process intelligibly. Now, there are huge challenges to doing this. And one of the big challenges that young people face is figuring out how to manage boundaries. Now, since I spend most of my time talking to teenagers, a lot of my examples come from there, but you can imagine how this plays out across larger audiences. One of the first complaints that I always get from teenagers is, why are teachers there? Right? What are you doing? This is social space. Get out. This is just like showing up to my birthday party. That's not cool. What are you doing? Right? And this is a real challenge because what, Chantel is highlighting is this is my space. I always loved the fact that MySpace was called MySpace because it was convenient that way. Facebook doesn't quite have the same nice, but it really is my place for my friends. Parents are, of course, another character that we love to harp on, right? Which is just like, Facebook is for friends, it's not for my mom, why doesn't she understand that? And part of it is that even when young people really love their parents, they're frustrated when their parents don't understand the social norms, and they embarrass them. This, of course, is not new. I love talking to Carmen because Carmen said, you know, my mother, she tends to comment on everything. I'm like, go away, not appropriate. And I said, well, do you delete her comments? And she's like, no, I really feel bad. I don't want her to feel bad, you know, but she's gotten better, right? And so I was like, well, what's the problem? Why don't you want her commenting? And she says, when mom comments, it's like everyone disappears after the mom post. Right? She's like, dead silence. I can't cope with it. It's supposed to be a social place. Mom's embarrassing. Right? So Carmen's in a state where she loves her mother. She wants her mother to be a part of her universe, but she wants her mother to understand the social boundaries. This is a lot of what you see in terms of the motivations and the drive for privacy. It's not a rejection from mom. It's not hiding from mom. It's wanting to have a space that's home and comfortable. So there's an implicit attitude in all of these conversations about who belongs and who doesn't. And why do people who think that they can jump in and have the right to be there just because they're older or have access? Just because it's there, just because it's accessible, doesn't mean you're welcome, right? And that becomes a challenge for thinking about boundaries. A way of actually thinking about this and thinking about what young people do to actually achieve privacy and try to manage it is by going back to Larry Lessig. Larry Lessig is a legal scholar, and one of the things that he wrote in his seminal text, Code, is that any social system is regulated by four forces: the market, the law, social norms, and technology or architecture. And what you see is that the market is driving, undoubtedly the market is driving all sets of ideas about visibility, all sets of ideas about publicity. And the technology is making that possible while also providing new tools for trying to actually create control. And so technology is serving both purposes. The law, totally confused. The law is not quite sure what it's doing or where it's going in all of this, but we start to see policies that have come into play in the meantime, whether it's a school policy or whether it's one of the site's policies. But what's often missed in these conversations is how social norms are a regulatory force. And what we see young people doing in light of privacy and publicity confusion is actually show the power of social norms. So I'm going to talk about some of the really fascinating strategies that young people are using to achieve privacy and try to actually gain control in a powerful way. The first sort of strategy I want to tell you is about the idea of asserting social norms. Like, you know, just like we heard with Carmen talking about how she was like, mom needs to understand, we see this over and over again. This is a picture meant to represent Hunter. By the way, none of the names and none of the faces are actual teens that I interviewed. But this is sort of Hunter, and he's really struggling because he is from D.C., and he lives in a community where his family is undocumented. His sister is, quote-unquote, as he calls her, ghetto. And he's really trying to participate in a magnet school that he's gotten access to. And he's really invested in a certain kind of formalized learning. And he's really good at it. And he's finding this sort of interesting struggle because, on one hand, the values and norms of his school are all about certain kinds of educational paradigms. On the other, what's valued in his home community is not. And he's really struggling with these two different worlds. And so, you know, he says this to me. He says, you know, when I'm talking to my friends on Facebook or I put up a status, something I hate is when people who I'm not addressing in my statuses comment on them. In my old school, people used to always call me nerdy and that I was the least black person they've ever met. Some people said that, and I said on Facebook, should I take offense to the fact that somebody put the ringtone white and nerdy is for me? And it was a joke, and I guess we were all talking about it in school, and my sister comes out of nowhere. She's like, oh, baby bro. And I'm like, no, don't say that. I wasn't talking to you. Right in this moment where he's trying to say, don't you understand this is what the norms are about? And of course, I said, well, how is she supposed to understand that? And he says, you know, I guess that's the point. Sometimes it's probably hard, but I think it's just a certain way you talk. I will talk to my sister in a different way than I talk to my friends at school. You know, and he gives us an example. You know, I might say, well, I fell asleep in Miss K's class by accident. And they'll say, oh, yeah, Miss K is so boring. And she, my sister's like, well, you shouldn't fall asleep. You should pay attention. And I mean, you can figure out that that's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a certain teacher. Right? You see this interesting conflict emerge. And this, by the way, is the challenge of a lot of these online social media. We have a constant collision of contexts. And so what we see is young people trying to assert a sense of social norms. Of course, Hunter has determined that this has failed. he can't make this work in a reasonable way. So he started actually using more structural strategies. And that brings us to using a technology or using the architecture to make things work. He figured out that on Facebook, you could block certain people from certain comments. And he decided that he would do this not because he was embarrassed by the information or he thought that that information shouldn't be made available to other people, but because he was trying to actually manage conflicting norms. Amongst his peer group, Pokemon and Legends of Zelda are like penultimate coolness, right? Which of course warms my heart. It goes back to like 1980s, wonderfulness. Amongst his family, though, it's all about shooter video games. And he finds that whenever he would talk about Legends of Zelda or Pokemon, all of his family members would just torment him maliciously. And so he decided that he was just going to block his cousins from any content that contained this information. Right? And this is a very functional strategy just to try to have a space where he can talk about Pokemon and relax. Right? And that's a really important privacy strategy. Of course, some of the most interesting privacy strategies are the most extreme. And I found it really interesting that the most extreme strategies are often taken from marginalized populations in their community. So Shamika from Washington, D.C., was really struggling with the fact that her peer group would create drama over anything that she would put up on Facebook. And they particularly loved to use the stuff in the past. So she started a practice in which she called whitewalling. And whitewalling is the idea of logging in every day and deleting every post on Facebook. Basically, removing all of the comments, all of the photos. She would post a comment, and she would log in the next day and delete it. She would let things stay for just a moment. She tried to turn Facebook into a real-time system, right? It's trying to use the technology in a way that was never intended to achieve a very specific privacy strategy. Now, this strategy is not by any means mainstream, but it's really interesting in showing an innovative way of coping with it. Michaela, another young woman, also had a really interesting strategy, which is sort of the flip side. She, too, was frustrated by not having control over real-timeness. And when Facebook decided that they wanted to make it really, really hard for you to delete your account, they put in this infrastructure where if you go to delete your account, it says, well, do you want to deactivate your account? Well, we'll save everything for you so that you can come back when you regret this, because we know you're going to regret this, right? And Michaela decided to use that in her own way. So every day she would log in, and when she was done with a session, she would deactivate her account. And the next morning, when she would log back in, she would reactivate her account, engage online, and deactivate it again. She could only communicate with people when everybody was simultaneously logged in. It became a synchronous space for her. And I was like, well, why are you doing this? She goes, adults only look at this stuff during the day. If I'm only logged in at night, no one sees it. It's like, that's kind of brilliant. That works wonderfully. And so this is, again, a way of repurposing the technology to achieve a goal. Now, more of the common sort of strategies that we see are actually trying to use social norms and social control without actually limiting access. So let's bring us back to Carmen. Carmen, who we talked about with her her mother sort of on Facebook. She had sort of the struggle because one day she broke up with her boyfriend and she was having a really bad day. She was feeling really emo. She really wanted to sort of pout and sort of say sad things to her friends. But she knew that if she posted something really sappy or depressive, her mother would think she was suicidal because her mother had a tendency to overreact to everything. And she really didn't want to worry her mother because she didn't think it was that big of a deal. And so she was trying to figure out how to communicate to her friends a way of what was going on and the fact that she felt sad without actually trying to worry her mother. She was very concerned about not worrying her mother. And the popular thing, of course, for young people to do is to use song lyrics to express their meaning. This is a norm. It's a norm. It goes back to my years. I'm sure it goes back even further of just like writing a song lyric to express oneself. Well, Carmen and her friends had recently watched a movie, so they decided to put up, she decided to put up song lyrics from that movie. And she put up the song lyrics from Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Now, for those who have not seen this sort of classic Monty Python film, this song is sung during the scene in which Brian is about to be executed. It is not a positive, happy song, but the song lyrics themselves sound very positive. Her mother, not coming from a culture in which Monty Python was actually a recognizable reference, had no clue what was going on and immediately commented, oh, it looks like you're doing great. And her friends immediately called her, right? They recognize that this is a difference. And what you see in this strategy is it's a way of making certain that there's access to meaning is separated from access to content. And this is really powerful because we're seeing this all across social media. One way of looking at it is through understanding it as social steganography. Steganography is the notion of hiding something in plain sight. It's an old cryptography concept. And what we see is that young people are putting things out. It's publicly accessible, but the meaning isn't. And it's just like what you might have seen written on a wax tablet, or what you might have seen, honestly, when the Greeks used to tattoo the heads of their slaves as the way of communicating messages. You needed to know where to look, and you needed to know how to interpret it in order to actually have access to the message. So we see this in all sorts of different ways, with young people talking about using pronouns, using references to things that people that might overhear don't necessarily know it. And again, this isn't that new. In fact, any parent out there who's heard their kids have conversations in the back seat and been like, they talked for half an hour and they said absolutely nothing I understood, right? It's the same basic technique, except that we're seeing it at scale and we're seeing it as a strategy that young people are using as they get older to really manage different audiences. Now, of course, they also flip it on their head, and they sometimes like it when you know that you can't understand it. When I was sitting with a young woman in North Carolina, I ran across various posts on her Facebook, and I was like, what is the meaning of this? And the two of them were, you know, I'm sick and tired of all of this. And it was liked by 32 people, and followed shortly there later by she's such a bitch, liked by 50 people. And I was like, okay, something's going on here. And I got a full rundown of all of the social dramas that were happening in this school and how these two girls were on the outs and it involved a boy and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And what these posts were is that these posts were referencing out and everybody in the school knew what was going on. All of the peer groups knew exactly who she was, knew exactly what this was, knew exactly what was being referenced, and they took sides. And the liking was the taking of sides. And, of course, the adults had no clue what was happening, right? And it's this way of making privacy in a very public place. A lot of what young people are trying to deal with is about negotiating these at different levels. It's also why things like the real names debate around Google+ are actually really important. Because a lot of what we see in these places is not about strict policies or strict regulation, but about the attempt to achieve something and work within a system to have some sort of control. Keep in mind that Facebook engendered a real names policy because there was something to be gained by sharing real names amongst peer groups. It was a really important thing for them to do because they wanted to be found. As Facebook became really hyper-public, what we saw is that the users who joined after 2008, the young people who joined after 2008, actually started using pseudonyms. Because once it reached a level of scale, they didn't necessarily want real names. And they certainly didn't want to have people tell them they have to use real names. Part of what's at stake here is that it's not about whether or not they're willing to negotiate or be found out by their friends or negotiated or understood by the companies, but a lot of it about having control over how information flows. And this information flow is a huge struggle in all of the efforts to achieve privacy. Social media has made a lot of things much more visible today than ever before. And at first, young people were sort of putting things up there and seeing it. But as adults started to get on these sites, young people started to come up with new strategies, and they're continuing to innovate. And when I look at the college campuses, I see tons of innovation of trying to manage it. Not all of it is very successful, mind you. It's a lot of experimentation, but you see this moment of trying to achieve some sort of control. All right. Let's go back to sort of your role as educators in all of this, because I think as I sort of map out these issues of privacy, of course they're intellectually interesting, but where do you play a role in all of this? In many ways, as you're watching and engaging with young people and you're helping drive their technology usage and you're helping them understand it, they need your help, right? Kids are not inherently digital natives. They don't inherently know how to use these systems. They've got a head start because a lot of them are experimenting and trying to figure this out. They're desperate to figure out how to manage these issues. They're very aware of the very real consequences of their parents and their peer groups. They haven't even begun to think about the government or industry as part of their conversationalists. They don't know how it's happening with their data at scale, and they're really struggling to make sense of this. The more that you as educators know about the different issues that are at stake here, the more you recognize that privacy is a complex issue, that young people are not just walking away from privacy, that they very much care about it, the more that you can help them navigate this space in a complex way. You know, I'm really interested in other cultural processes to try to figure this out. Jean Briggs wrote a beautiful ethnography called Inuit Morality Play, where she talked about the emotional work that goes in as young children learn how to do morality work. And one of the cases she talks about is, you know, a young boy runs up to his mother and is just like, you know, I hate Bobby, he's mean, he's evil. Like, you know, he took my toy away, some version of this. And the mother looks and goes, well, why don't you kill him? And, of course, again, from an American context, that's just like, what? You can't ask that. But, of course, the little boy is just like, that's not the right response. Right? And they go through this negotiation between parent and child to try to figure out what's right and what's wrong. As educators, as you're thinking about what it means to do critical literacies in a networked environment, a lot of what you can offer more than anything else are the critical questions, the ways of asking people to think and reflect and take a different perspective. Because the challenge in a lot of this is about a challenge of perspective. It's about twisting things around and seeing things from a different point of view. You know, when my freshman year in college, I decided in a state of various rebellions that I was going to shave my head. And my mother, who, bless her, is in the audience now, remembers this with horror. And I was proud of myself, and I was prepared to talk about the patriarchy, and I was prepared to talk about feminism and what it meant and gender and beauty and whatnot. And I went home to see my grandmother, and she looked at me in that calm way in which grandmothers, only grandmothers can do, and she goes, it looks like you were in the Holocaust. And I remember just being like, that was not what I was prepared for, right? Like, you can't sit there and talk about feminism when your grandmother's responding with the Holocaust. And I remember just having this moment of, that was not a perspective that I had ever imagined in my various states of rebellion. A lot of what happens is that the more that young people are interacting with different audiences, the more that you get to hear different perspectives. Not necessarily judgmental ones. And you can't just necessarily go out and say, you're never going to get a job. You go back to privacy, because it's like, I know how to rebel against that. But more, how do you start and have the critical conversations? And as you think about the employing technology and in your campuses, a lot of it is about sparking those critical conversations. Alongside this, there are also huge challenges that you yourself have to ask about what it means to deal with privacy and publicity, and what it means to give your students opportunities and also create new challenges. In one hand, you desperately want to help young people figure out how to be a part of the public world in a respectful and responsible and ethical way. They need it for their future of their careers. They need it to be successful in this society. They need to know how to navigate these highly public environments. But exposing them isn't necessarily the right way. In my fieldwork, I came across a really sad situation. A young woman who was in high school, who had moved 3,000 miles away when her father was just about to be released from jail in order to avoid the possible consequences of him finding her. And, you know, she and her mother were really struggling with what it meant to set up a new life in this environment. They were very conscious about everything with regard to social media. And then school started publicizing honor roll lists and putting up, you know, experiments in the classroom where all of, you know, students' artwork was put up online, and all of a sudden her location becomes accessible again. Right? And that's a heartbreaking extreme story. But part of the challenge is as you help young people navigate these spaces, you can't just expose them. There's a serious cost about it, because even if they are willing to be public, there's a very different sentiment between their engagement with the public and your exposure of them to the public. And that's something to deal with as you're you know, thinking about this in an educational space. As educators, you have the amazing power to help youth navigate it. As people who are employing technology or putting technology into the campuses, you get to choose the infrastructure that will help them deal with it. You get to put down a framework for helping them think and bounce off into another environment. They need to learn how to navigate these networked publics, and they're struggling to do so on their own. The more that you understand about the complexities of privacy and publicity, the challenges they're facing, the difficulties of exposure, the opportunities of publicity, the more that you can actually help them navigate the future world, which will be highly networked. I can't say that there's sort of, you know, one guaranteed way of doing this. This is still very much an experiment in process. And so I hope that you will actually experiment with this, struggle with this, challenge it, have a conversation within this community. This is a powerful and beautiful community of people deeply engaged with issues of technology. Leverage that community to struggle with these issues. Thank you very much. the exciting news is that I have left 10 minutes for questions, and I believe that the numbers there, one, two, and three, are actually microphones. And I would invite any of you who are trying to think through this to ask questions, maybe. Yes.
Hello. I'm a little tall. Being sort of a technologist, it's real interesting to hear about the way people are using norms and different social contexts to achieve technology or to achieve privacy. One of the things that's really interesting to me is in these networked publics, we in the broadest sense of the term, have tremendous control over the architecture, that being public doesn't need to be the default. I mean, what are your thoughts as to, what are some of the appropriate technologies to employ in achieving privacy versus letting this play out in terms of social norms and social context?
Right. No, I love your question. I think one of the things that's really interesting is to realize is that the technologies aren't the end-all be-all when they're social technologies. You may design for one thing, people will repurpose it for another. Even something like Google Plus, which was all designed for circles and narrowed down, was quickly used by the Robert Scobles of the world to be highly, highly public, really quickly there and after. I think the bigger challenge is not to say that you can design it guaranteed, but how do you design it so you're negotiating the audience simultaneously? You're working with them to co-design it. So it's not a design, develop, and deploy system as much as it is a tango with users. And what this also means is that anytime you're going to shift things, it's actually the shifts that you worry about rather than the initial design. So if you've designed a whole ecosystem where the norms are very public or the norms are very private, shifting it has consequence. So you look at something like Twitter. Most people who embrace Twitter embrace it as a very public media. Now, given 10% use protected accounts, but the majority of people come to it and say, okay, I'm going to navigate this as public. And that's not because public is good or bad, that's because they've learned how to manage it or they've chosen not to engage with it. It's a very different set of issues when we design something like Facebook, which people develop social norms around assuming that it's extremely private, and then they get made public. And it's that act of exposure that becomes daunting and difficult. So as you're thinking as a technologist, part of it is not to say that any one design norms are better or worse, as much as you're designing for different kinds of possibilities, and you want to work with the constituents that you're engaged with to make certain that it meets their needs, and you want to help them evolve the system. And that you as a designer can't just come in and change the norms and expect for happy constituents as a result. Yes?
Have you found the kids to have success in educating adults about the acceptable norms?
It's funny. Some, yes, of course. This conversation is always hysterical because, a lot of it comes down to what the values and norms are within a particular community. When adults are willing to hear that young people might actually know something, there's amazing conversations that can be happen. But when adults don't want to hear it, kids aren't going to manage to teach them, right? So a lot of it is openness on the part of adults and recognizing that each of us have different experiences. The challenge as an adult is to say, it's not about like back in my day, right? Back in my day doesn't work, right? These ecosystems are different. And what you want to try to understand from a young person is, why is what they're doing completely rational and sensible from their perspective, given their experiences? And the more adults are willing and open to this, the more that can be learned from young people. And the reverse is also true, right? When adults come in and try to help young people navigate these spaces without saying, this is how it should be, but more like, this is one other thing you might want to think about, a lot more traction is gone. In the space of social environments, a lot of it is a co-learning process. Right, and it's about engaging and engendering that possibility of co-learning, but it means openness on both sides. And whenever you see a failure to open by young people, by adults, it becomes a very difficult task. Yes?
I'm wondering, in your research, if you're looking at how young people do the knowledge transfer, because every new student who comes to this has to learn this from people that are already using it. Are you seeing dimensions of microgenerational differences?
Yes. There are key actors that help young people learn to navigate these spaces. My favorite of which are, older cousins, older siblings, people that are part of a broader peer group that they respect and they trust. I will also say there's an amazing amount of norm setting happening by celebrities, particularly celebrities who engage in social media. These are people who they admire in any given way. Now, amongst their peer groups, there's tons of conversation. Keep in mind that, you know, most social media usage is used by people who know each other everyday environments. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to be able to skip over and avoid drama, right? Drama is pretty much a guarantee in all of this. In any type of social space, you get the various dramas that unfold, and there's a lot of learning that goes into that drama. And you really want to avoid the really serious and significant and damaging drama, but there's a lot of it that's more lighter weight. The learning is interesting because the learning is about learning to be a part of a social world. And that is not something that you can just skip over, right? It's a process. But it's, what's interesting is as the technologies change faster and faster, what it means to do that is also different for each micro generation. So when I, you know, talk to, you know, current college seniors who, for them, you know, freshman year in high school was all about MySpace, right? Their ideas of this are so different from the freshmen that I'm currently dealing with. And I think that's one of the powerful things is these ecosystems are changing fast. The general ideas are still there. The general ideas are important. But the details of how to work out specific technologies, too quick, far too quick. Yes?
You've talked a lot about the social circles that the youngsters are dealing with. How much is their choice of forum based on their trust of the service providers and, you know, Facebook changing the rules constantly, those kinds of ideas?
Sure. Very little. It's interesting. There's a recent survey, actually, I want to say it was last summer, about Facebook's reputation amongst young people, which was abysmal, right? The company had terrible trust, lower than cell phone companies, right? That's not a good sign. But the thing is that doesn't mean that they're not using it. Because what drives it more than anything is a matter of where their friends are and where people are hanging out. They love the affordances of, you know, a service like Facebook, but they're frustrated with the loss of control. But rather than thinking that the answer is to jump off it and find a different place, by and large, they're trying to make sense of the environment and work within what's available to them. They also have to deal with the fact that, frankly, they miss, you know, I love talking to young people who are like, I miss it when Facebook was just young people. And you're like, okay, just like you'll hear from college students, I miss it when it was just a college site. It was much better then. Right? And you have this moment of like not being prepared for larger audiences. But it means that we keep seeing these evolutions of systems. At this point, Facebook is a very big, powerful, all-encompassing structure. It is really useful for certain things. But I don't think it's going to be the end-all, be-all. Right? It doesn't mean that it's going away. I don't think it's going away anytime soon. But I think that you're going to see niche services providing complementary options. And so, you know, even in data that we're seeing about Facebook usage, whenever you see other services usage, it's Facebook plus the other services. So I think it's more that way. Just like, honestly, people don't have very many nice things to say about their cell phone company, but they still use a cell phone, right? And so I think we have a lot of different issues there about, you know, what choices are and what it means to actually focus on the goal of socializing as opposed to our love or hate of the brands. Yes?
Hi. Thank you very much. I really appreciated your observations about how the one student was navigating his racial identity in the context of school versus home, and was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about sexuality and particularly about gay and lesbian kids and how they're working to do disclosure or containment around that.
Right. LGBT youth, I'm in the middle of a process where I'm trying to actually figure out different things that are going on with LGBT youth. It's important to realize that in the history of social media, the first adopters have historically been self-identified geeks, freaks, and queers. And I don't mean that pejoratively. It was very much people who went to technology because it empowered them to break out of the marginalization that they were facing in their home community. And what's happened is that as these technologies have become mainstream, there's been a totally different kind of struggle for marginalized youth, and particularly LGBT youth. LGBT youth are still using niche sites to go and find support and do emotional work, but they're also struggling with network media, particularly when they're in very homophobic environments. One of the things that I'm really grappling with right now is that we're seeing, I mean, the It Gets Better campaign, for those who missed it, was sort of a beautiful campaign driven by celebrities and then very much mass adopted by people to say, hey, you can get through these young years, it gets better. And what's been really struggling to me is that there was another suicide last week in Ottawa of another young boy who had actually participated in the It Gets Better campaign. And this big challenge of how do you move from It Gets Better to Make It Better. And it becomes a really difficult struggle in this. Bullying is a very real aspect for certain marginalized youth. And what's really difficult is that there's a huge difference between what we think of as drama and what we think of as bullying. And I really want to make this clear because in a world where we talk about cyberbullying as any form of harassment or relational aggression or gossip or rumors, etc., we need to actually understand that there's two different processes. The first is actually all sorts of dramas that are between people and they're at various levels of torment. And then there's bullying. Bullying has three components. Bullying is a form of social, psychological, verbal, or physical aggression. Two, repeated over time. And three, between people of different power. With this social or physical power. What this means is that when we deal with marginalized youth, and particularly LGBT youth, they are almost often the victims of bullying. Once they identify as such, they need a whole set of supports around abuse that we're often not providing them. And the media is actually raising all sorts of complication around it because it's lumping in digital drama and it's lumping in all sorts of things that we call cyberbullying with that. The kinds of support are very different. For those, actually, I'm beginning a very big project around this whole space. So for those of you who are working or interested in this, please contact me and we can talk more. I will answer one more question before we have to go.
Yeah, I had a question about permanence. I think a lot of us in this room are really happy we didn't have Facebook and photos of us floating around when we were 18. So I'm wondering what you think is going to happen to even 10, 15, 20 years with a lot of this stuff floating around and some of these students no longer 18 and are 35 with families wondering what kind of pictures are still available inside Facebook.
Right. It's been interesting to watch how these things play out, and the most heartbreaking thing to me to realize is that there's a whole set of privilege issues around this, right? So, you know, if you look at adults, just stick with adults and what they put up on Facebook. How adult is perceived if they're doing a kegger is different than how adult is perceived if they're drinking wine at a dinner party. It's both about alcohol, but it's a perception of alcohol, a perception that's driven by class, a perception that's driven by a whole set of other factors. The same ends up operating for young people. I think that for the most privileged youth in this country, their participation on social media and the kinds of things that they expose are going to become the norm, and it's just going to be acceptable, right? It's just going to be acceptable that this was part of your youth. What's difficult for me is that those who are not in a position of privilege are going to face a whole set of different challenges over this. And I think that we actually have to deal with these as a sort of, you know, spectrum of issues as opposed to embarrassing or not embarrassing. It's like embarrassing with privilege versus embarrassing with no privilege become very different factors in all of this. I think that we're going to accept a lot of the things that people did as youth as just being funny and embarrassing. I think they'll be used to expose them, but I mean, I'm amazed at watching politicians manage to eschew this conversation. I will say Barack Obama did a phenomenal job of just ignoring the cocaine issue during his campaign. I think we'll see these kinds of issues of just like, okay, you have a picture with a red cup. All right. But I think that there will be young people who will suffer serious consequences from it in the way, or in the whole process. And I think it's one of the challenges for all of us is to make sure we can stand up and speak on behalf of young people and not let them just automatically be judged, right? Because the best minds of this generation are on Facebook. Thank you.
That was great.
Thank you.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.